I'm Dr. Elliot Malamud, and I want to briefly introduce to you these gentlemen who I'm sure you all know by now, if you've heard their wonderful presentations this morning. To my far left is Rabbi Nadi Helfgott, who is the chair of Tanakh and Jewish Thought at Yeshivat Chovei Torah. To my immediate left, Josh Berman, who teaches at Bar Ilan and is a fellow at the Shalem Center. To my immediate right, Rabbi Menachem Liebtag, who teaches at the Gush and is the founder of the online Parsha Shiur that many, many people around the world subscribe to. And my far right, Rabbi Yitzhak Etshalom, who is...
First time I was on anybody's far right.
Who is in Los Angeles at the Shiva U High School there, as well as the Simon Wiesenthal Center. We wanted to bring these experts in Tanakh together to really wrestle with some of the issues of Tanakh that are challenging for us in our day, both as readers of Tanakh, as teachers, as parents, as Jews. I wanted to start with something that comes up immediately in Sefer Bereishit, which is the lives of the Avot and Imahot, and here I want to pose kind of a multi-layered question that almost anybody who reads Tanakh with any sensitivity will run across, and it's a very difficult challenge. We know that many of us are aware that Rabbi Hirsch has famous comments about the fact that the mistakes of the Avot are not something that we hide, and that they were not superhuman, and the Torah is not attempting to hide their failings. But I want to pose several questions in this regard. Seemingly, the idea of telling students or family members that the Avot are not superhuman and they have human failings would seem to get around the problem of whitewashing the credibility of the text. But the problem is that you now raise an issue about what makes these people so special, and do you actually undermine reverence for these figures? So my first question is whether the idea of not hiding the flaws of the Avot only deepens the educational problem, because if we can see that the Avot made mistakes and even engaged in rather some dubious behavior, and all of us can pick out our favorite stories of behavior that we find morally problematic, how do we maintain the requisite piety toward these figures? How do we teach children to maintain a requisite piety towards these figures? And how is the balance between honest criticism on the one side and reverence achieved? So that is where we're going to begin.
Okay. I'll begin addressing the question. I think the question is even more intense in the sense that it's not only a question about addressing the moral or tactical failings of individuals. In parts of the Orthodox community, the ideology has taken hold that it's not just a question of mistakes, but emotions. And emotions like love and hate and things of that nature are things that are devoid. One should not speak of the biblical characters as having any emotions. They were superhuman. They were superhuman in the sense of not only they had no failings, but they weren't human beings. I think there are two issues here that are very, very important. Number one is we try to teach truth to our students, and part of the truth that is taught from Tanakh and Chazal and the Rishonim, the overwhelming majority of the Rishonim, is that they took them as great human beings. At the same time, they were people of emotion. When they loved, they loved and they hated, and they did great things, and they also made mistakes. So the first question is, you know, part of Ner L'Ragleinu has to be truth. The second thing is about your educational question. I think that one of the problems that we deal with is the lack of sense of progression and development in characters. Meaning the assumption of that question is that people never change, or that people never make mistakes on their way to achieving greatness. Meaning, so I revere great people, but at the same time, I recognize that in their achievement of greatness, they overcame all kinds of pitfalls to achieve them. And I think that educationally, it's a very important message to try to teach our kids. I'd like to read a passage from Rav Huttner, Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner, who was not a modern Orthodox Jew, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Chaim Berlin. He has an unbelievable letter in the Igros and Ksavim, letter Kuf Chaf Ches, where he talks, some young man sent him a letter talking about the problems he finds with Lashon Hara, that he can't find himself, still finds himself not able to hold himself back. Maybe there are people in the audience that don't have that problem anymore, but I still have that problem. And this young man, and he writes, and this young man writes with, you know, very upset and depressed about his spiritual status. And Rav Hutner writes, Ra'acholahi etzleinu k'shekasher mitaskinanu b'tzadei ha'shleimut shel gdoleinu. When we talk about the aspects of perfection of our great ones, hinenu mitaplim b'sikum ha'acharon shel ma'alatam. We often attribute, we take them when they're 10 years old, and when they're 20 years old, and when they're 40 years old, as being equivalent. And he writes, Haroshem shel sichatenu lagdolim itkabel kilu yatsu mitachat yad hayotzer bekomatam ubetzivyonam. We present to our kids as if the gedolim, or in our purpose, the avot, came out ready-made, already perfectly fashioned, without any sense of development, of struggle in their life to achieve what they did. And listen to this. Hakol mesochachim mitpalim urimim al neis et torat halashon shel bal haChafetz Chaim zatzal. Everyone speaks of how great the Chafetz Chaim is, the poster child of not speaking Lashon Hara. Aval mi miyodea mikol ha-milchamot ha-mavakim ha-michsholim ha-nefilot va-nesigot la-achor shematza ha-Chafetz Chaim b'derech ha-milchama shelo im Yitzro Hara. But who speaks of all the mistakes the Chafetz Chaim made? All of the days when he didn't live up to his stated ideals? All of the times when he fell and then he arose and picked himself up off the ground. And he says, and therefore, V'day l'navon shekamot chaladun min ha'prat el ha'kal. Hatotza mizehi kishenar bal ruach, bal shifa, a person of spirit, a person of ambition, of religious ambition, when he finds himself or herself in trouble, they somehow think that they can't achieve anything. I think that here is a very powerful, and I think the educational message that we need to teach, it's one that the Chazal certainly spoke to. Chazal, when we first meet Moshe Rabbeinu, he turns away from God and he hides his face. And Chazal say, Tiron la nevuah haya. He was a tyro. He was in basic training. He wasn't yet at the point of Moshe Rabbeinu, who I always point out in the middle of this sefer. Not only doesn't he turn away from God, he speaks to God panim el panim, and the people have to turn away from him. He's achieved that level of godliness. People struggle, and great people become great people. And I think that that's a very important lesson that we constantly have to speak about the different stages in the development of great people and the different moves that they make. And even when they're at their pinnacle, they also sometimes make mistakes. And that doesn't take away from reverence. Just as a child learns, they come to a more sophisticated understanding of the relationship with their parents. When they're 5 and 6 year old, they may think their parent is God. When they're 15, they think their parent knows nothing. And then when they're 30, they realize, oh, wait, as Mark Twain said, all of a sudden the parents learned something between the time that they were 15 and they were 30. Somehow my parents became very smart in intervening 15 years. I think that that's a major element here in terms of the richness of a character, understanding the idea that people develop, and great people don't come out. David HaMelech didn't come out of the womb, David HaMelech, number one. Number two, that part of our tradition is the totality of a person. And that gets to the educational question. In Achanami, if someone gives a class or someone teaches about David HaMelech, and the only thing that they teach about David HaMelech is Batsheva, even if they use language which is appropriate and respectful, then that gives a skewed perspective. David HaMelech, the Batsheva incident, was a very important story in the narrative of David. But it's not the only story. And if you only constantly harp on the mistakes, even the tragic mistakes of someone, then that also gives a skewed perspective. David HaMelech is the David HaMelech of the totality. The David HaMelech of Sefer Shmuel, and the David HaMelech of Divrei Yamim, and the David HaMelech of Sefer Tehillim, all together. And it's the totality of the picture that creates a sophisticated and reverent tone. And third is, of course, the language that one uses. One has to make sure that the language one uses is appropriate. The language which uses is sophisticated, articulate, and is not flippant. To talk flippantly is not appropriate for any context. So those are the elements I would make in my
First, I just have to say that as I sit here, I feel like I want to pinch myself because 25 years ago, when I was 18 and in my first year in Israel, I was in a Beis Medrash with the three other colleagues here on the dais, and I can say that each of them in their own way had a very formative impact upon me, and if I'm sitting here, it's only because I had the schus of being around such individuals. I felt I had to say that.
Okay.
Yes. I remember once, the first time I visited London, and you know, you get to the curb, and it says that there's instructions, look right, look left, very helpful, like pikuach mamash atzelas nefashos at the end of every corner. And I remember then I went to Golders Green, and you know, here's a Beis Medrash, and here's a yeshiva, and here's a shul, and here's a kosher bakery, and everything is just so infused with kedusha. And I got to the corner, and I expected to look at the instruction and for it to say, look up. And I mention this because I think that's very helpful in terms of dealing with the reverence issue when we are critical of the Avos. I find it remarkable, you know, Chazal spared nothing from the Avos. And in fact, sometimes read in faults and mistakes that aren't even in the Pshat. And you have to wonder, what were they thinking? And I think that for Chazal, the main thing was that the reverence, which is such an important part of our Avodas Hashem, was not primarily reverence for this personality or that personality. They knew where reverence is. Look up! It's for a Kaddish Baruch Hu. There's one hero in the Tanakh, and that's a Kaddish Baruch Hu. And the same text and its holy author, who judged the different characters in different ways, he is the only one worthy of reverence. And when you see how the Tanakh so sensitively addresses the different faults and mistakes of its great heroes, it doesn't detract from our reverence. It's because our reverence is primarily owed in a different direction. It's not to the characters, it's to the text of the Tanakh and to the Ribbono Shel Olam who stands behind it and himself stands in judgment, which means that we have to be in judgment of ourselves.
But, you know, let me just go back on that. In a way, you're talking about audience, right? So maybe, ironically, it's easier for Chazal to criticize because the foundations of belief are taken for granted, right? We live now in an era that Stephen Carter calls the culture of disbelief. So really, it's very tricky when you're dealing with students, let's say, or family members who are not so taking for granted that these are even great people. You know, Natty, you said, like, they're great people. Even that's not taken for granted, right? If a student comes across Yaakov sort of tricking his brother, so to say a sort of saver pshat saying, well, you know, they're developing and so on, but it could be even worse than that. A person can say, I don't see anything here at all to admire. I don't even see why I should even care about this person. So I'm wondering if the audience today, right, when they see the avot criticized, it doesn't come with that balancing of, but I have kind of underneath a rock hard, you know, emunah for these people. So that's where it becomes difficult to know, what do you do now?
Well, Elliot, it's, to me, you know, your alternative is not a real alternative. Meaning, the lack of quote unquote reverence is going to be there whether you teach the Yaakov tricking story or not. It's not going to be further undermined.
I'm just don't teach them Hebrew and they won't.
Right, they won't know anything about Judaism. Right. So that, I think, is a question of context. In Ochanami, if the only thing you're going to teach is Yaakov tricking his father, and that's the totality of your Yaakov experience, then in Ochanami, that's a distortion of the text, it's a distortion of the message of the Bible. And as Josh said, the fact is that in the very next parsha, the text itself is very critical of Yaakov. He gets midah keneged midah. Everything in his life, he suffers because of that. And that's teaching us something about where, even to achieve great ends, it may not be the right thing to do to trick your father. And that's a lesson that Yaakov has to learn very bitterly. And that's part of the lesson of learning Judaism. And that's very sophisticated. And I think that the issue is not about teaching this text and avoiding that text. The issue is what kind of context you make if you have schools and homes and communities in which what we would call Yirat Shamayim not in a narrow sense, but in a broad sense of spirituality. And it's a counterculture thing. The culture is not a culture of belief. We are counterculture as Jews committed, but it's a sophisticated counterculture. if you don't create that in Hachanami, but it doesn't matter. Even if you skip it, so they're going to say, oh, you skipped it because there's something, you know, you're trying to hide from us. The issue of is context. Do you have schools? Do you have homes? Do you have communities which are infused with spirit, which try to go to spirituality, which speak of Yaakov in the totality of his experience, which are rooted in Tanakh and Chazal and later writings? And in that context, I think you must teach it honestly, because the alternative is not, oh, the alternative isn't the kid is going to say, oh, these are Malachi Elyon. The alternative is going to say, Tanakh is totally stupid. And therefore, we should make Tanakh interesting, sophisticated, and right on target.
The better solution is not to teach it. That's been the minhag.
Right.
And it works pretty good.
Right. Can we actually talk about that for a second? In terms of curriculum in schools, often you see in yeshivot, there's a sort of a heavy emphasis on Talmudic study, and less so on Tanakh. And I'm wondering, what do you think should be the place of Tanakh in a Jewish curriculum today? And I mean to really talk this way. In other words, the kid is in yeshiva 12 hours a day, and do you feel that there's a kind of mistake that's made by downplaying the role of Tanakh? And if you do, how would you effectively incorporate a Tanakh curriculum?
To answer that, I want to go back, basically, to answer to both questions. Yeah. The assumption of your first question was that these were great people, we have to revere them. And there's a deeper assumption is the reason why God chose us is because our forefathers were great. So if you're basing your whole religion is, we're the Amma Nifchar. No, God chose us, our forefathers were great, and because, b'schus of us, what they call, what is misunderstood, is because they were so great, God gave them all these promises, and we're privileged. It's our schools, you know, it's all genetic. We were chosen, and Baruch Hashem, they were great grandfathers, and we have to have a sakaras tov to that. And all of our privileges is because they were great. Then when you read the Bible, you have to find that greatness in the story. You have to make up stories that they're great. But Chumash wasn't written, and then also assumes that Chumash is a storybook. It's a chronicle, and this is the story of what happened. If you understand Chumash being given to Am Yisrael at Har Sinai in preparation for receiving the Torah, and the reason why the stories are being written, and the reason why the book is being written, isn't to tell you what happened. The reason for the book is to explain to the people of Israel why they were chosen. And I think as an enduring understanding to our children, we have to teach them, but we're not chosen because they were better. We're chosen to be better. We weren't chosen, what's called Hitalech Lefanai V'yetamim. Brit Milah begins with that statement that Avram is chosen not because he was great. Chumash doesn't tell us anything about his greatness. The Medrash fills it in for a very good reason. But you have to emphasize that we're chosen to be better, not because we're better. And then in light of that, if you're going to be critical of the Avot, you have to understand that the reason why the stories are there, it's not being written, oh, here's what happened. The reason why Chumash is going out of its way to tell us how the Avot developed their character, so they become a paradigm for us to learn from. So we spend our entire life of improvement. We're chosen to be better, and we have to act better. And if there's a story in the Bible, that if we're going to be critical, it's for the sake of our own, of making ourselves better, and realizing why we're chosen. And then make what's us saying, to look up, and not to them. I think educationally, I think the big mistake we're making, I think it's might be a result of Christianity, no, filtering in, but the idea that we have to have these saints, and that's the reason why we're chosen, and being better. So, now, that might have happened because of hundreds or thousands of years of persecution where people are telling you're nothing, you're vermin, you're terrible, you're nothing. So living in Europe, when people feel that way, you have to tell a Jew you have to be proud, you know, and you have a culture, you have a proud. Therefore, as you can see, you say you have to build, you know, you have great forefathers. But when we're past that stage, I think the emphasis when we study Chumash has to be on why the book is being written, why we're studying the book, and we're not studying it, oh, here's what happened. I'm not questioning what happened to happen. Chumash is being written to teach us our relationship with God. In light of that, and therefore any critique of the forefathers, any biblical character, as long as it's in the framework, how can I take this story to make me a better Jew? Then now it's legitimate, it's what should be done. If it's for the sake of, oh, what do I care? You know, I can be rotten, they were rotten, then it's a disaster. Right. And often it seems that way.
I can certainly echo what all of my colleagues have said here about the problems. But to speak, Elliot, directly to your question of curriculum, and I think it does dovetail back to this, is I think there are two different issues when it comes to, at least in secondary schools with curriculum, I can't speak to elementary schools, with the sad overemphasis on Gomorrah. And the reason I say that is because, and I think you mentioned this in your comments, is that until really the middle of the 20th century, Jewish education was not, well, perhaps certainly till the middle of the 19th century, Jewish education was not something that was accessible to everyone. And the idea that everyone is going to become a master of Shas was not even thinkable. Now that Baruch Hashem, Jewish education is available theoretically, although finances is a different question, is available to everyone, somehow this notion that the curriculum has to be Gemara has taken root. It's very sad for two reasons. It's sad, first of all, because it means there's whole pieces not only of Jewish knowledge, but of necessary background without which the context of Gemara and the context of Jewish belief and Jewish history and Jewish values are inaccessible. And then we get to the old joke about how we know that Moshe and Aaron are brothers because it's Mefurash HaKtzos. That's a curricular problem, pedagogic problem, perhaps. But there is a far larger problem, one that I'll share a personal experience about. Anyone who has ignored the tremendous growth of Jewish education, I can't say in this country, in this continent, and in Israel, is missing a tremendous thing to be proud of since World War II. On the other hand, anyone who congratulates himself and says, we're doing such a fantastic job and everyone's getting more inspired and more committed, is sadly and dangerously ignoring the reality of who we're graduating. And part of the reason is that there are many, many students who come through our halls who we are not effectively touching. And part of the reason is that we're trying to fit everybody into the same square hole. And some of them are round pegs and some of them are triangles. And a number of years ago, I'll share the experience, a number of years ago in the school that I worked, I was asked to begin an alternate honors program for Tanakh. Instead of an honors program for Gemara, an honors program for Tanakh, where the main course of study would be Tanakh, and the students would have 45 minutes a day of Gemara and 45 minutes a day of Chumash, and the rest of it was Nevi'im, including a Mishmar once a week in the evening and special programs, a retreat, and it was very successful. It was pulled after a year because I was told that when people come around from yeshiva to check the students out, they won't be impressed by what they know about how to interpret a piece of pottery or how to check the etymology of a particular word and its Assyrian roots. If they don't know how to read Gemara, they won't be accepted to the yeshiva, which, by the way, is probably not true. It's probably not true because probably the people who come around from yeshiva to visit are much more concerned with someone's dedication to learning, someone's curiosity, someone's ability to interpret a text, and obviously they have to have some background. But there was a sense there that we can't honorably call ourselves a yeshiva high school if the main thrust of every student's day is Gemara. The reality is it doesn't appeal to everybody. Besides everything else, it just doesn't appeal to everybody. And there are many students who get very, very turned on by serious study of Tanakh. And there are many students who get very turned on and very excited by serious study of Jewish history. And I've for a long time maintained that any student in a yeshiva high school should be given the option to major in one of these three areas and really feel a sense of mastery and a feel of connection, not totally ignoring there are certain courses that every student has to take, and that they should find their chelek b'Torah. So there is, on one hand, the question of how much every student in the school should be exposed to Tanakh and exposed to serious methodology of the study of Tanakh, and that's one question. There's another question is to what extent should some students be offered the opportunity to make that their main focus of study? I think that we need to rethink our entire curricular structure to make not only secondary education, but post-secondary education, post-high school education, I mean, to make opportunities like that available so that people who will, of course, be erudite and well-learned in the writings of Chazal, but whose main focus will be from a biblical perspective, and that we should, again, not to be reacting to the Christian takeover of Tanakh, as it were, but that we should take it back, and we should proudly take it back, and that we should develop schools and mastery of those who really are experts in the study and teaching of Tanakh.
I wanted to ask, you're talking about, you know, Tanakh is stupid, right? Alienation from Tanakh, right? And there are people who feel this way, and there are people who feel this way and don't express it. And I think that one of the reasons is that there are so many parts of Tanakh, especially in Chumash, that seem so foreign, so utterly alien, right, to the modern reader. I don't think there's actually an enormous amount of honest discourse about this, but you know, if my students don't feel alienated by it, I provide the alienation for them because I am so bewildered, right? And it doesn't really require much recitation. If you look at the Akedah, if you look at the, you know, we just read in Shul yesterday about Amalek, and if one reads the history of Jewish thought on Amalek, you know, potential genocide, institutionalized slavery, sacrificial system, rebellious son who gets killed, fines for rapists, and on and on. It was just a litany of what I would call almost indigestible Torah, unusable Torah. So I guess I'm asking both ideologically and also pedagogically, what do we do with this sort of unusable Torah?
Okay.
Yeah. Can I just ask a question to clarify what your question is? When you say, what do? You mean as teachers in school and curriculum, or what do we do internally in our own learning?
Yeah, I don't believe those two can be separated. In other words, what do you first do as an intern? How do you process this,
uh-huh.
and how do you communicate it?
There's an assumption out there which leads to a big problem, and that assumption is that it's often mouthed and accepted simply, but it's simply not true. And that is the statement that the Torah is eternal. And therefore, everything that we read in the Torah, Lefi Pshat, is eternal. And therefore, all the punishments that are meted out that Eliot stated are eternal. And the views of, having multiple wives is eternal. And this is simply not true. People hide behind this because they assume that reverence for the Torah means making such a statement. And Chazal never believed such a thing. The Torah has evolved since day one. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. There are two camps about the question of the evolution of Torah. One assumes that all the mitzvot, all the halachot that we have, are all basically given to Moshe at Sinai. That's what is spoon-fed almost across the board in our world today. But there are many sources that say just the opposite, that say the Torah has evolved, the Torah has responded to the times. And I'm not just talking about academics and people with some type of agenda, feminists, God forbid, or something. I'm speaking about very holy people. I'm speaking about Rav Tzadok Milublin, who never saw the halls of an academy. I mean, he had a big strimal and long payas and a big beard. And the Netziv, and when you read what they write about how Torah has evolved, what do I mean by that? That many of the halachot that we have were not known to Moshe Rabbeinu. And they evolved over time. And Chazal darshaned because they recognized that there was a need to change with the times. This is part and parcel of so many, many mikorot, but we're afraid to say it today. And it's precisely almost every one of the issues that Eliot raised, Chazal, over time, managed to soften them, whether it's about Ben Sorer or Moreh, or whether it's about multiple wives, taking many wives in marriage. And we need to get accustomed to the idea that a lot has evolved over time in halacha and in thought and in social issues. I think that we're afraid to say that because, again, it comes back to the reverence issue. But if we understand that many Gedolei Yisrael engaged in this themselves, then it's something that we're allowed to think about as well. Now, having said that, this process of adapting to the times, of actually changing and updating halacha, is something that got frozen in time, somewhere around Chatimat HaTalmud, at the end of the Talmudic era. But in principle, the idea that over time we need to check what are we doing and is it appropriate for the times has always been part and parcel of the whole system. It needs to be tempered with conservative, with a small c, sense of reverence for tradition, that things move slowly, but they do move and they do change. I mean, just one simple example. Even after the period of the close of the Talmud, the Rambam writes l'halacha that a woman should not go out of her house more than two or three times a month. This is halacha that he writes. I don't think that there's a single community in Israel, the most right-wing, fanatic, Haredi, whatever, that adheres to that.
What's that?
We're getting there.
And they're going to quote you.
Yeah. And so I don't think that there's anything wrong. I don't think that there's anything wrong with sharing with students, yes, this is what was done back then, and it's not what we do any longer. And when you tell them that Chazal themselves realize that things need to be updated, then it allows you to maintain the sense of reverence. And again, the key is to measure between what the needs of the time are with a very deep respect and reverence for the tradition, and that things need to move slowly. I mean, we've seen this in our own time. The opening of Beis Yaakov was a revolutionary thing. And as women's learning has grown, each step has been somewhat of a milestone, has caused somewhat of an uproar if we're teaching women to paskin halacha in this area and that area. But it's being done in a slow way that on the one hand reflects the need to move ahead and to adapt to the times, and at the same time is very reverent of a long tradition, and therefore the moves that are being made slowly. And I think that there's many voices in the tradition. They don't get heard, but they're definitely there. There's a wonderful book, I'm assigning homework until the next conference, by a scholar named Jay Harris called How Do We Know This? That really chronicles this very issue. Were all the halachot given at Sinai, or were the halachot evolved over time? And he goes through the entire history of rabbinic literature, charting that there have always been two voices. But today in our schools and in our shuls, you almost universally hear just one voice. And it's important for us to know that that other voice also exists.
The Jay Harris book is actually an excellent book, but you don't read it in Toronto, you see.
I'm sure somebody will explain that to me. What Dr. Berman said, Rabbi Dr.
Josh
said, it's certainly true, but there's another piece of what Elliot asked that has to be addressed also, which is the, I can't say these words, Tanakh is the S word. That we hear students saying, which really comes out of two different places. One of them is the list of examples you gave of where either stories or laws seem to be morally indefensible, problematic, et cetera. And then there's a whole passages that we might teach which just are very disconnective. One of the things we have to decide is what we're going to teach and why. We don't have to go out of our way to teach selections that are going to create that kind of crisis.
Right.
And if we design our curriculum in such a fashion that we begin with basics, and basics not only textually but methodologically and chronologically, so that those other laws are then seen against the background which the students are familiar with, then it's a lot easier to introduce a certain methodology which makes it easier for them to integrate it into their world. As an example, if you're going to start a class, and you want, I mean, we all have this temptation to do stuff that's controversial and as we say in L.A., that's sexy. And I don't know, I'm sorry if anybody doesn't know what that was. But
provocative.
Provocative, thank you. I just got off the plane, I don't know. And we all like to do stuff that's really going to titillate and excite. And so therefore we might want to start off with some sugya or some passage that people are shocked by or wondering by and get them interested. But that's not pedagogically smart. We want to build our curriculum at whatever age it is, and certainly in high school and in those very formative years, by teaching sugyot and Tanakh and sugyot and Chazal that establish the basic framework of halacha and some of the things that Josh talked about the evolution of halacha. Then you want to enter, and I think there's a slightly better way to do it than directively entering it, but you want to enter into a sugya like Amalek, which is thorny, a sugya like slaves, which is thorny. And then you teach it with some serious method which involves introduction of sociological background, historic setting, context, the economic system of the Near East during biblical times without which in which slavery is, it's impossible to imagine a world without slavery, just on a commerce level. If you're able to introduce students to that, meaning that you have introduced them to a world in which Tanakh is part of a real world with history and with other nations and with wars, etc. And in that context, you say, I'm going to show you documentary evidence from the period of Tanakh where you see slavery is rife, where you see that sale adoptions are part of what happens, where you see how conversion happens in different styles, whatever it may be, and now we can look at this text, and against that background, let's see what it means. And then we get to the issue of eternity, which is, that doesn't mean we're going to do things the same way today. Let's try to figure out, given that background, what is the Torah ultimately trying to teach by initiating this sort of legislation? And what's the message that we're supposed to take from that? And how do we apply that message in our lives? Now, the better way to do that is to let the students ask the questions. And so what I do, for instance, in my class is I promise them, if by Thursday we've completed all the material that we've set out for the week, Thursday night you email me any questions so I can prepare the material. I don't want to come in cold. And we'll have an open discussion Friday, but anything you want to talk about. Wow. And that way they can ask the stuff that's on their mind, and they come up with some serious questions. And I come in with some sense of preparation, and we're able to have an intelligent discussion about something that's really bothering them. But they're also ready to hear things in a more sophisticated way because that's the way we've been teaching.
I just want to pop in one second. So it sounds like what you're saying is that, because it's very interesting to me, because a lot of the way that Tanakh is studied is very book text heavy, right? Pasuk Rashi, Pasuk even Ezra, right? It's in this vacuum of the text. And it sounds like what you're saying is that if you're unaware of biblical geography, biblical sociology, biblical politics, ancient Near East sort of culture, the way you learn Bible is just going to be impoverished, that you can't get at certain things.
No, I think it wouldn't. I think impoverished is not strong enough for a term.
Oh, I see.
I think if you I think you're not reading at all.
So what
if
you
don't have a sense of the historic context, that doesn't mean you have to know every component.
So what
if
do
you don't have a sense of the historic context, then I don't think you know what you're reading.
So what do you think is going on in our schools?
Depends who's teaching. Depends who's teaching what school.
Yeah. Right. I want to defend the other side for a minute about eternal and the thing. First of all, in our education system, one of the lowest goals is education. And for a good reason. The main goal of our school system is inspiration. Ask any principal. The main thing the parents want, it reflects the real situation. We want our children to be educated and get good grades, but it's more social on the one hand. But the main thing we want our children growing up Jewish. We want them to be good eating. We want them to marry Jewish. We want them to be, like us, even a little bit better, which is true, which is more important. And in general, if something's not broken, don't fix it. And therefore, don't be surprised. It's not so terrible. Bottom line, things aren't so bad. And if I want to take the analogy that Josh was giving about the change, when change happens, I think we can appreciate that. Change, if you want to take an analogy from Hasidut. Hasidut was a reaction, right, to European life. Now, when Hasidut began, it was borderline. I mean, examples from Toronto is simple. You know, are they in the camp or not in the camp? No. Can it be happy? Can it do it in Orthodox or not? And there was tremendous opposition. We call them Misnagdim. Everyone knows that history. Now, the end result, that wasn't bad. It wasn't a question of good or bad. It's that, schism is the word?
Yes.
That thing that one side says you're a trade, the other side says we have to do this. I think the growth is not necessarily singular, that the person itself, the group itself, but the growth happens as a community. And there's some value in this opposition. Right? There's some value in one group wanting to change, wanting to move things, but there's even more value in the opposition. And at a leadership level, education level, even as an understanding level, not to be so upset and all of a sudden know who's right, who's wrong. I think Am Yisrael will grow much better as long as we appreciate it's very good that there's tremendous opposition, because there's a lot of danger in saying, oh, once you say things have to change and it's not eternal, it's so easy for those messages to be misunderstood. Like, I can totally agree with Josh's thing, but what he's saying sounds so dangerous at the educational level. And the kids, the last thing they care about is understanding the text, right? They want to have, that's a question of one time. They want to be inspired. They want to be what's called, and that's what we want them to be. If they understand davening or don't understand, it doesn't matter, as long as they daven. We want them to daven. And I'm serious, it's an important thing. And in many ways, the question is, how can we use textual study to make them better Jews? I don't think the goal of our education system is to make them educated. That's long gone, that's long. If there's a question, you ask a rabbi. There's plenty of people studying. And when you're planning a curriculum, I think the more important thing to do is simply to ask yourself, what do I want to graduate from my system? And one of the tools in making them better Jews is how you teach Tanakh, but it's got to be, I wouldn't say, I'd be against the idea of having, you know, the special Tanakh program, the special Gemara program. I think to understand Gemara properly, you have to have a solid background in Chumash. Understand Chumash properly, you have to appreciate Gemara. And this departmentalizing, I think sometimes can be, again, we can argue that among, you know, teachers and stuff like that, but there's definitely a value in a wider picture. And I think, like, I bring example to my students all the time. We learn something. I show them, you've been saying something in davening, like, Hodu L'Hashem Kiru B'Shmo. People say that every day they start davening. Yaukein Kabbalacha. There's a lot of sections we say in davening that you spend a half hour in class, or like the pasuk of Shema Yisrael. When I teach different dvarim, people are amazed. Their whole life they've been saying Shema, and they never realize what they're doing in Chumash. They say all these things in davening, and it takes a half hour lesson, 1 hour lesson. And it's so simple, and all of a sudden davening becomes meaningful. And I think it's just a question of how to incorporate it. And the question you get all the time from students, how come they never told us this in high school? But I think we have to reinvent the wheel. We have to take what's existing, and we have to take really appreciate the tremendous growth there is in Jewish education, inspiration, and there's a lot to it. But slowly, like almost in a, you know, it's okay to be a little exaggerated to one side, but appreciate the exaggeration to the other side. And slowly, right, and not say we have to reinvent the wheel, to slowly try to filter it in. And it will blend in. As long as it's done with dedication, I think it will.
I'm curious. You know, if inspiration is the goal, so you should teach them meditation. You should teach them Kabbalah. You should teach them, I'm being perfectly serious. You should teach them all sorts of, you know, spiritual trends and techniques that are taking place out there. I happen to believe they should be teaching them anyway. But if, and I'm not even stating that ideology a priori. So it's not clear to me that the curriculum is currently stated. If you tell me that this is the goal of what want.
And I think that's the goal of the system. I'm saying that's what's driving the system. Meaning we want the end result. How we get it, it's, if I'm a principal, and I have two teachers to choose from. One who's a great chevron, he can play guitar, he can play basketball with the kids, he can get them singing Friday night and stuff like that. I have another guy who's got very little people skills, but he might be like a tremendous teacher and knows tremendous things, have 15 doctorates and stuff like that. The average principal today is going to prefer the Heberman, the NCSY guy, because bottom line, that's what we need. Now, it would be also nice if the kids would learn something, but that's why we send them to Israel. You follow? No, the goal of the high school system, get the kids to Israel. If you get them to Israel, they'll be okay. Because they're going to learn that.
Go now.
I love Menachem. He's my teacher, but sometimes he exaggerates in some of his formulations. I agree with a lot of it, but I think that I think a teacher has to be charismatic and has to be inspirational and all those things. And I try to live up to that, but at the same time, I don't think that it can be devoid of content. And I think that we have, and I don't think you either, obviously. And I think that we believe that through the teaching of text, that we can ultimately inspire for something that's going to be long-lasting, meaning
enduring.
It's enduring, meaning it's very nice that you have the NCSY type of thing and all that in a positive way. But I want the kid when he's 25 or in graduate school or in college, a sophisticated kid, that he's not going to come back and say, you know, I didn't think about these things, that we weren't taught about these things. And when you teach text can be and should be inspiring if you make sure, and that's the ultimate goal. Why do we teach Tanakh? I always ask novice teachers, why do we teach Tanakh? If it's Talmud Torah, there's a lot of other things in Talmud Torah. Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, Mishnah Brura, Gemara. There may be things that are better Musar books. The Magid Says series might be a better way to teach how you deal with your parents rather than learning the Yaakov story. But we believe that there are fundamental things about Judaism, about our place in the world, about things like covenant, about brit, about God, about relationship, about the ultimate goals of the world that we learn from Tanakh. And that's why it's so essential to teach Tanakh and to teach Tanakh and to show how content and form come together. And that's essential to do it right. So that's why I want to say first. Second of all, in terms of what Josh said and the different caveats, I think it's important to throw in what the Rishonim taught us. They took what Chazal said in a different direction, but fundamentally, that's the approach that we, I think, identify with, and that is Dibrat Torah Kilshon B'nei Adam. The notion that the Bible speaks in language of human beings, which means that the Bible is not some ephemeral document that's inaccessible, that it's a document that was written in biblical Hebrew of a specific period, given to a specific people at a specific time, which means that we have to understand biblical geography, biblical language, history, politics, and all that, in order to understand the eternal message that's encased in the Bible, which means that I believe that ultimately the biblical message is eternal, even, and the Bible is sui generis, even if its modalities of communicating that are not sui generis, meaning that they're not unique, that I will find cognates in other, you know, etc., etc. But the ultimate values about monotheism and tzedek u'mishpat and all the things that the Torah keeps coming back to are unique, are eternal, and the Bible conveys that. So the literary techniques are not sui generis. The modality, Am Yisrael were human beings who lived in the ancient Near East and used, and God chooses to use forms of communicating that to Am Yisrael, Allah the Rambam and other things. And that's true. At the same time, and in the context of that developing, Chazal themselves understood that there were fundamental messages. And so when we talk about the development of halakha, it's about halakha. It's about, do we see, take a malik for example. Is a malik an exception or the rule of the way we should be living our life and educating our kids to? Should we be educating our kids to, that's the way you should, meaning, and that's exactly what Chazal struggled with. And that's exactly what the Rishonim struggled with. And that's what we should be struggling with and trying to tease out the fundamental messages. Is a malik an exception or not? And what we do with it? And what's the Torah trying to say? And what's it about ultimate evil and all those things? So I think that that's a very important component in this whole discussion. And I would recommend another book that's worthwhile for somebody who used to be in Canada. The Rosh Yeshiva of Male Adumim has a wonderful book called Derech HaTorah, which is a very worthwhile book that addresses some of these questions.
This is Rabbi Rabinovich.
Rabbi Rabinovich.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Could I just address Menachem's point briefly? Menachem, I love you. I'm so honored that I was seated to your right. But I don't know if I could disagree with you more. I don't know if there's any way I could disagree with you more. First of all, I think the choice is a false choice. The choice between a chevreman who can get the kids singing but isn't going to teach much, but the kids are going to love him and everything else, and the guy who is a good teacher but doesn't have people skills, I think neither one of those is possible. First of all, kids don't like teachers who don't teach. If a kid is in a class and all it is games and singing and kumzitz, after about a week, the kids start to resent the teacher. Stop wasting my time.
Kids, you get a weekend.
But it's not true, because even the week they hate. Kids like to be challenged. Kids like to feel success. Kids like to feel mastery. That's first of all. Second of all, it's impossible to be a good teacher without good teaching to good people skills. We know that pulling somebody out of a university environment or an academic environment who happens to know a lot about stuff but doesn't know how to talk, that's not even a beginning question. But if somebody has actually got good teaching skills, got good pedagogy, but he might not be able to play guitar or play basketball, he might not even have such a friendly mannerism outside, so then you have a cheshbon. I have somebody who's not as good of a Rebbe type and won't maybe have the kids over to his house as much for Shabbos dinner or something, and I have somebody who will do more of that, but the dichotomy that you presented is a false dichotomy.
Well, I wasn't saying that's what should be. I'm saying that's what is.
No, but I don't think it is. I don't think you ever have somebody who is a pure Heverman and can be successful in getting the kids happy over the course of a year but not teach. And I don't think it's possible to have somebody who is a good teacher but has no people skills. The issue is far narrower than that. But the second thing is that I feel frustration working in an environment that says what you say, which is, let's just get them to Israel and they'll learn there. And by the way, the word that we're getting back from many institutions in Israel is, we don't want you to just get them out and get them to Israel, because sometimes you're sending us people who not only don't have the background, they don't have the maturity, they don't have the attitude, they're not ready to come here, and they're creating problems here. Because that's what you deal with. Every year I keep trying to get more. We cannot honestly take $10,000 to $15,000, which I guess in Canada is about $500,000. I don't know what the rates are these days. We cannot honestly take a tuition from parents and say we're simply having a holding pattern. Pay for a Shabbaton, have somebody get up with a guitar, and the rest of the time let them have Limurei Chol and the secular studies and leave at 2 o'clock and go get jobs. How can we honestly take money and say we're just trying to keep them in a holding pattern so they'll stay Jewish, marry Jewish, and somehow before marrying Jewish, go to Israel? We have an absolute obligation not only to educate, but we have an obligation to have the kids fall in love with text and have their inspiration dafka be from the text. Guitar playing is important, but if guitar playing is the substance of their excitement, we've done nothing. The Shabbos tish is fantastic. This is a Friday night. We had 50 guys over for a tish, a Tu B'Shvat tish. It was fantastic. The kids were singing. Great time. But who are the kids who came and had a great time? These are the kids who also get excited about learning during the week. And the other kids who came, so they came and they left. They had a few buffalo wings and cholent and whatever else we serve. They wouldn't eat the dried fruit. And because dried fruit and cholent just don't go together. And they left. They weren't affected by it. It's the kids who are serious about learning and serious about their connection to Torah on a textual level who also get to the next point. NCSY is a fantastic organization as a starting point for kids who aren't yet connected. But you can't live your life at a kumsitz. And, I mean, I know people who do, and it fizzles out. And so I believe that our mandate is very much to take education with the education as inspiration, not in place of inspiration. And that the way that we educate and the people that we have to hire are people who embody the values, the famous story about Rabbi Riskin and who we finally chose for his Masifta, people who embody the values, people who are passionate about the subject matter, people who, to the best choice that we have, can relate to the kids and talk to them and be makar of them. But if you have somebody up there who's passionate about the material and has some basic ability of classroom management and some sense of organization, they'll get the kids learning and they'll get them inspired. And then when we'll able to send far more of them to you than we'll have to send to the remedial schools where kids go because the high school didn't get them to step A.
All I was saying was that the teachers, I'm sure, that those teachers you're talking about are all medical school, investment banking. They don't become teachers. We're stuck with talking about the material. I'm saying that instead of...
He's insulting.
Yeah, what? No, not you. A couple of people.
I guess I'm medical.
No, but the people, if we had really good teachers, fine. But I'm saying instead of rewriting curriculums and everything, take what's existing, and slowly blend it in. I agree with everything you're saying, what should be. The question is how to get there. No, I know where, I'm saying where we are at A. I'm saying where we are at A. You're saying where we should be at B. We're just arguing how to get from A to B. Okay.
I just wanted to add an Israeli perspective to this. If I'm suffering from jet lag, then maybe there's a good reason. And I base the following comment on a subject pool of one, my teenage son. And but I think that it's perhaps reflective of something going on in Israel and just sort of rounds out the conversation. There is a great crisis amongst Israeli religious youth now in the wake of disengagement. And regardless of what your position is on that politically, for many, the whole dream just suddenly went up in smoke. And then the question becomes, well, what does this mean about everything that we've been taught and all the great ideals and promises, etc.? And what I see is that basically Israeli youth, Dati Leumi youth, go in two directions. There are some that go radically towards the inspirational side, and the dream is still whole somehow. But then there are many others for whom now they want to know, now that the dream has been shattered, anything that you tell them, they got to see it inside, and they got to know the alternatives, and they want to look at things with a critical eye. Now, obviously, they're facing a whole range of issues that youth here aren't facing, but I thought that was something that would sort of give a different perspective just on how these issues, at least as I see them, are playing themselves out in Israel.
I want to follow up on a couple of the things that you said, Josh, and that you said, Yitzhak. You're talking about eternity versus non-eternity of Torah, evolution of Torah. Partly the confusion for the student is that, A, there's a kind of slippery slope that enters into here. Right? If you look at certain things out of the Bible and you say, well, that was then, but it isn't now. So the question is, where's the stop line for that methodology? I'll give you a perfect example. I teach at Queen's University, which isn't far from here, and one of the things we do in the course is talk about Judaism as an interpretive tradition, and we were actually doing the Sugya of Ben Soramor. And we go through it, and we talk about, obviously, the sort of shita that it never happened, and that it's simply there to get schar for studying it, but my students, it's very odd, because they were stuck. On the one hand, they despised the story, right? Because for a modern, it's anathema that you take out your child and stone them for, eating your meat and drinking your wine. On the other hand, this was the fascinating part, they were very upset at the conclusion when one of the shitot is, well, it didn't really happen. We just because, you mean it's all theory, right? So in other words, you're stuck in between. Because if it's all theory, as one of my students said, so maybe other things are theoretical too. Maybe the part about,
stoning people who engage in homosexual sex is also theory. And in other words, where does that stop is one problem. So in other words, to me, one of the fundamental dilemmas of learning Torah is trying to understand where do you actually balance off between what I think is a correct insight that it's evolving with this notion of permanence. You know, so you could argue that if it was written today, maybe the Bible would have different language, but the ideas are permanent. But the truth is, on an actual pedagogical level, it's enormously confusing to know where does this stop. That's one. I'll give you a second story. A colleague of mine who's gone back to Israel, Shliach, was the most talented teacher, actually, that I've known. I'm not going to say who it is. He taught me for 3 years at Chad, and he taught his students that he believes that the Garden of Eden story is an allegory, and he believes that the flood story is an allegory. And so every day I used to speak to him, and I said, so actually, where does history start? He says, well, probably it starts by Yud Beth. Exactly, by Avram. So I said, and why isn't that allegory? And that's where the conversation stalemated. I mean, he gave me certain reasons, but they were not convincing, right? So I am trying to find out, for myself primarily, and then I can pass it on to those that I corrupt, where are we with this?
So I think that the case of Ben Sora Mora is so beautiful because you see, Chazal couldn't deal with it, and so they wrote it out of the books. And so, therefore, I think that would be something that would thrill modern readers. And I think that it opens up for us the possibility of doing somewhat similar things. I'll just take an example of how, I mean, you know, our communities everywhere, Israel here in the U.S., are beginning to struggle with the issue of homosexuality and how we view it. And I think that opinions and beliefs and dispositions that we might have harbored even just 10 years ago, we're now sort of rethinking, and it's not a question of mutter or usser, but how do we deal with those in our midst who are of this orientation? And I think that it's a wonderful thing, and we get the license to rethink these things precisely from seeing these issues in Chazal, that when they realized that something didn't quite fit, then they were able to change. So Chazal were able to make a bold statement that Ben Sora Mora lo haya velo nivra, that it never happened. We cannot change what the Torah says on anything, but we can realign our disposition a little bit, how we relate to such individuals. And I think that knowing that the history of Torah interpretation has been one of adaptation and changing, I think is something that gives us real fortitude.
Right, but you realize what you're doing. I'll get you a second, Addy. What you're doing is, and I appreciate that, you're taking a small-c conservative view to it. In other words, we can't go radical on it, but it gives us license to be a little bit more tolerant of that. But, of course, there are many people who look at that and say, why should I restrict myself that way? Why should I limit myself to simply being more tolerant? It's teaching me to be more tolerant of the homosexual as opposed to saying, no, textually what I see is that Chazal were able to say, no, that doesn't apply, that doesn't apply, that doesn't apply. Why not me? Right? So you're really talking then, you're entering really now the realm of politics and rabbinic authority and so on. It doesn't just stay on a textual level. Right, Natty, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that. I mean, I think that, you know, in Begadol, I agree with Josh that that's what's, you know, a lot of this is what's going on. I think learning the methodology of Chazal is a very important thing to talk. Here we really left the realm of Tanakh, qua Tanakh, Pshat, and you have to talk about the relationship between Pshat and Midrash Halacha and how Halacha evolves and how Halacha develops. And like you said, the two strands, do you take the Rambam's approach that not every single Halacha that we keep today was given at Sinai, but a lot of it was given in potential, and Chazal drew it out, and the authority. And yes, that's a very important thing that we need to teach our kids, that there were certain meta issues that Chazal felt were so important that they colored how they read other stories. Again, I keep coming back to what's an exception and what's the rule. And Chazal had authority that we don't, and that's an important thing. That's part of what makes us Orthodox. Part of what makes us Orthodox is a recognition that maybe certain things should change, but we don't have the authority to do it because we live within a system that's developed in a certain way, and we cherish that, and we at the same time understand. Let me give you a small example, again, from somebody who wasn't a modern Orthodox Jew, and not talking about a Doiraisa, but somebody was once talking to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Zichron Livracha, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and he was talking about, it doesn't make sense to him, certain halacha, something about, medicine on Shabbos. You know, we don't use most people don't use medicine on Shabbos, and the Gemara says because it's a gezeira shema, you know, a shchikas samimani, because they used to, you know, grind up the mortar and pestle. And Rav Shlomo Zalman said, yeah, you know, when the Sanhedrin comes back, we're going to change that. He just threw that out like a, he threw it out as like a, an offhanded comment. Meaning that he himself understood that there were things that may have been mituk. Now that, of course, we're talking about a derabbanan, etc., etc. But it speaks to a recognition that there are certain things which are eternal in the system, certain things which are not eternal in the system, certain things which we don't have the authority to change, but if we could, we would change, etc., etc. And that's also part of a sophisticated training to our kids. And there are certain things which are unique to a specific situation, you know, and... You know, you talk about, you know, Rav Kook writes about the issue of war. You know, do we fight wars today the same way we fought, you know, 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago or 4,000 years ago? And Rav Kook writes, you know, obviously the ideal of Tanakh is to reach a world of the Gar Ze'evim Keves, right? The pacifism. But if Am Yisrael had, you know, put that into practice, to live in a non-redeemed world as if you're in a redeemed world is to commit national suicide. Am Yisrael had to fight wars, sometimes very harshly, and yet he always wanted to stay one step ahead, and therefore the laws of Jewish war are far more progressive in the context of the ancient Near East than the rest of. But at the same time, you have to be harsh, and you have to be... And the question is, as we progress, what are the laws, how do Chazal develop it, how do the Rishonim develop it, how do the Achronim, we live a living tradition. And that's the way we have to teach. We have to teach sophisticated, with a commitment to the values that Torah is trying to convey to us, and how we put them into practice. And sometimes that's part of being in Galut, and not only Galut, but part of the fact that we don't have the ideal means that we can't change certain things, even if we want to. Just like in America, there may be certain things that we would want to change in the Constitution. Because, you know, and probably many people in this room that would want to change. But until you have the legal mechanisms, three quarters of the states and all that, it's not going to happen. And sometimes, and change evolves very slowly, and that's okay. And it may have attitude changes, and it may have other things that affect how poskim, you know. Okay.
There's another component to the issue, which is one that for a lot of us brings a lot of discomfort, but it's a historical reality and it's a pedagogic reality, is that when we look at a biblical text, we're looking at two different things. Especially when we talk about the area that you've spoken about, which is law. We're looking at the legal text, and a great way to teach this and to initiate students into that is to teach the Ibn Ezra or the Rashbam. We look at a halachic text, for example, and the way that they deal with it as parshanim is in one way, with missing one jot or tittle of the halacha. So Ibn Ezra will say, this is what Pshat says. Example, the Rashbam on Vayav Ukshatam Liyota Yedecha Vayilot Tutafot Peninecha says, Al Derecha Pshat, it really should be understood metaphorically. And they said, right, that it's to be close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Nobody in the right mind would think that Rashbam skipped one day of putting on tefillin because that's metaphoric. But we look at the text, we look at it through two different eyes. And this is a critical piece that cuts really to everything we're teaching. When we study Tanakh, and specifically when we study Chumash, we are studying two different things. We're studying an independent text that has to be studied as a text, using textual tools, using historic background, literary style, etc. And we are also studying a framework of halakha, or the skeletal text of halakha, to which has to be added the Torah Sheval Peh. And that he said, without Torah Sheval Peh, we're not Orthodox. We're not Jewish without Torah Sheval Peh. Rav Saadia spent much of his career demonstrating that fact. So when we study Ben Sora Mora and say, well, how come they could say it about Ben Sora Mora, we can't say it about Mishkav Zachar? That's exactly the answer, because they did say it about Ben Sora Mora, and they didn't say it about Mishkav Zachar, as an example, because that's a big part of what Torah Shabbat Peh is. Now, at what point do you say that Chazal were manufacturing that both parents have to be the same height and have the same voice, and the child has to be exactly no possible years old, etc., in order to make Ben Sora not work, that they were manipulating the facts to make that happen, or to say that that was their tradition of how to read the text? That's a very interesting question to deal with. And that's really the question about whether Midrash or Mishnah, which comes first.
But on the other hand, that does not in any way get in the way of our studying the text of Amalek, or the text of the Arayot, or the text of the Nsor Moreh, or the text of Bava Machteret, and textually understanding it in a way that we have a certain freedom, because we know that whatever conclusions we're going to come to textually are not going to affect our adherence and commitment to halakha.
I just want to add one thing. I think what Yitzhak said is so important here. I'm sorry. I think what he said is so important. I just want to flesh out. There's fundamentally in the medieval tradition two approaches to text. One is, and here I think the Ibn Ezra and Rashbam are actually on opposite sides of the... One approach says that a text has one meaning. Fundamentally, there's one valence to a text. That was the Ibn Ezra's. He had a Gaonic tradition that said that if I can work hard enough, I can discover what the meaning. And therefore, Pshat and Drash, I always have to find a way to make them live on one plane. And the greatest example of that in our, not our, but two generations or two centuries ago was the Malbim. That the Malbim worked so hard to show, especially in light of the Reform attack on the Torah Shebaal Peh, that I want to show that every halacha is really shot in the text. And the Rashbam comes from a different angle. That, I think, that methodology will not work. I think ultimately it leads to a mavoi satum. It leads to, what's the translation of mavoi satum? A dead end. It ultimately leads, because we get into all kinds of intellectual dreidlach that are not helpful. I think the Rashbam really set out the model for a sophisticated modern Orthodox conception that says the Bible, we really believe this is a divine text. If you really believe that, then kifati shifotzet sela, as the Gemara says, the text speaks on many levels at the same time. At the same time, it tells me pshat. At the same time, it is the basis. I use a different methodology. There's a pshat methodology and there's a drash methodology. And both of them are equally true in their own world. And both of them teach me values and ideas. And both of them have what to teach me. And the living God wants me to learn these things through the methodology. Pshat has its own methodology. Drash has its own methodology of the Yud Gimel Midot and the Lamed Bet Midot. And that's how I derive meaning from this eternal text. And that's what I think we really have to somehow strive to teach our kids, especially when it comes to legal material. And that, I think, is ultimately, you know, where we can, you know.
Well, if our 15-year-olds were 30, all that would make a lot of sense. But what we're discussing, in my opinion, was wonderful if we're talking about education for adults. And I just think, in reality, there's certain, in the existing system, with all its problems,
right,
you learn Pasuk Rashi, you grow up with that, there's a beauty to it. And I've had students sometimes that had, my students as teachers, and they come to yeshiva, and I don't know what to do with them, because they don't know the standard stuff, and they just all the vortlach, and there's something basic missing. You can't, but one of the problems of our teachers we have in high school is that when they were in yeshiva, they learned all these cool things, in Torah Shabbat and everything. They got this, you know, vort, they got this, so they got all these things. And we teach our, we want to wow our students. Like, what happens is, kids go to a shir and they say, how was the lecture? How was the shir? Oh, it was great, it was amazing. He knows so much. That's what they would say, he knows so much. They ask him, what was it about? I guess in my notes. And they, but what was the main point? Then he starts saying, and they can't get up. What were they amazed by? But they were so amazed because, in essence, what was the goal of the shir? You see that. The goal of the shir is I want to amaze my kids.
Right.
And what's happening is, what the kids see, 10, 15, they just see all these, you're giving them a 1,000-piece puzzle. You're giving them 50 pieces of a 1,000-piece puzzle. They never see the box. And they can't, I don't think they're able to put it together. Now, the question is, given that situation, what basics do you give them? The love of learning, again, how to do it, my point is you have to slowly incorporate what we're talking about, but all these discussions about, you know, complexity and there's one way that, a couple of nerds in high school might pick up with that. The average high school kid wants to finish the daf, I finished the masechta, I'm making a siyum, you follow? I did mahadur, etc. You can't fight that. No, it's unhealthy. I think it's unhealthy to start rethinking the whole system. You got to take what's there, let them learn Chumash Rashi, and then with that, help them understand, like when I teach Rashi, or, you know, tell them the famous shitas with Nechama is that what was bothering Rashi? I try to like upgrade that a little bit. What's bothering you? And then if you want to appreciate what's bothering Rashi, it's got to bother you first. I'm saying, but all these ideas are wonderful, but I think it's too quick to change and too quick to rethink. There's something really basic about education. Again, I'm not saying inspiring it and making them brain dead. Right? I'm saying it's so important in the society we're living in. that we've got to take the system that's working and make it a little bit better and not totally, you know, reinvent the wheel.
I'm not sure that I fully agree with you. In fact, I'm sure I'm not. I think that, I mean, in my sense of it is a little different. I also agree, I think you have to teach skills.
Yeah. And all these things are so good for adults.
Right.
And adults would be tremendous if people do
that. But I disagree. I think that just as in Gemara, I think that in high school you should be teaching kids skills of how to read a daf and how to see the development of a sugya. And maybe by the time they're 11th and 12th grade, baby lumdus, meaning what's throwing out an idea or two, a hakira here or there, which will then be the basis. The same thing in high school and elementary school. I want to teach my kids some fundamental skills of seeing the whole message of a book, seeing the division of a chapter, seeing the division of a sefer, the goals of a sefer. And from mihaklal haprat, not to do every single complicated mahalach of Rav Yoel or anything like that in a sefer, but that they get that.
And you're preaching to the choir on that.
Right, I know. So I'm saying, including this, I think for as kids, especially in high school, I think they're sophisticated enough to begin the discussion about pshat and drash in an intelligent way, so that we can start to, you know, when they're in college and beyond, to really fully integrate it.
I'm going to get to you. I'm going to ask one last question, then we're going to throw it open to the floor for questions. Just a comment here, and I think it's something that Rabbi Echelon said at the beginning that is very sound and needs to be repeated, which is that a lot of this depends on the context that you're teaching in, right? In other words, your assumption that this is what they need is an assumption based on a system that's healthy. In other words, but in a school where kids are bored and alienated, where it's not healthy, where in fact teaching them that is not what they want, it won't work. And in a school where your assumptions are sound, then the methodology will be sound. So I think it's very important to adjust to, like, who am I teaching here? What are their given theological background? What is their given pedagogical background? What do they know? What do they believe in? What are they capable of, right? And you know, so that there's a lot that goes into this. I wanted to ask one last question that I think...
Can I just make a point about what was discussed before? Is Menachem make a very good point about many of the things we're talking about being appropriate for adults. But the reason for that is because if you think about it, our 15-year-olds, our 16-year-olds in high school in the afternoon, by that I mean in their secular studies, are dealing with very sophisticated, complex, textured concepts, whether it's in the humanities or in the sciences. And frankly, I'm embarrassed as a Torah teacher to think that in the morning, in Limudei Kodesh, we have to present things in a purely inspirational and very simple kind of way because they can't handle more difficult concepts. And yet their English teacher is presenting them with very textured discussions about what Shakespeare might have meant or even what Chaucer might have meant. And it's really kind of frightening. I think part of the problem, and there's something beyond the ken of what we can do here, at least accomplish right now, is we don't have a curriculum. We don't have a curriculum. If I'm a social studies teacher, and I'm teaching the development of the American history, I'm teaching the Civil War, I've got a textbook, which is an appropriate textbook for 11th graders, for them to research the issue of states' rights, and you've heard of the Civil War, of states' rights, I apologize, I keep forgetting, I brought my passport, I keep forgetting, of states' rights and of slavery, et cetera. And
I got
a
PBS series I can show occasionally.
Right, I got Ken Burns, and I can also send them to the library or to the internet to do more advanced study for the nerds who want to really get into something more special and do extra credit projects. I can do a whole range of things. We don't have that Limudei Kodesh. First of all, there's no school curriculum in many schools. There's certainly no national curriculum of saying that when a student graduates this network of yeshiva high schools, he should have or she should have these skills in Chumash, these skills in Tanakh, this basic level of Yediot Klaliot. There is no such thing. Which means, by the way, every teacher has to create everything by himself or herself. Which is
why? Why is it so the last 2,000 years? Why haven't we got a curriculum yet?
Well, I'll rephrase. Oh, it's a good question. I'll rephrase your question. Why after 50 years there's no curriculum? I'll explain why I'm changing it for 2,000 years. Because the notion of any sort of a unified school system within the Jewish community is a post-World War II notion. Jewish education as the legacy of the masses is new. And the notion of a system is new. So
2,000 years, I mean, it makes for good press. But in reality, we do have to ask that question, why are we still already in the 21st century and we don't have a curriculum? Why are there no standards by which a visitor from Los Angeles can come into a yeshiva high school in Toronto and walk in 11th grade and expect that the students will be at more or less this level of knowledge and vice versa? It should exist. And by the way, if it were to exist, Menachem, we could do a lot. And that's not reinventing the wheel. That's clarifying the wheel, right, and sharpening the spokes. And then we could do a lot more of the sophisticated stuff because the pieces would be in there, and a student who, let's say, failed 10th grade would have a summer school curriculum so that they could enter 11th grade and not just say, well, Nebuch, you're going to 11th grade even though you didn't succeed. And then we graduate people who don't know, and by the way, who aren't very inspired because they don't know.
What? No. Question period is coming right up. One last question, and then we're going to throw it up to the floor. True story. Several times a year, I get together with psychiatrists, and we have a sort of group in which we talk about psychiatry and spirituality. And over the years, they've told me lots and lots of stories about, some of the clients they've had, all sort of anonymously. And one of the stories that stuck in my brain was that one of them had a student, a teenager, as a patient, and the teenager had asked a question in school about how do we know that the Torah is true. The student was in a sort of a right-wing school, and the student was quite maligned by their teacher for asking that question. My question to you is, we've been talking about the Tanakh after the truth claim is taken for granted. Do we need to talk about, in schools, the truth claims of Torah? Is it from heaven? Do we need to talk about revelation and how it works? Do we need to talk about the authenticity of its divine status? I'm not necessarily talking here about do we need to get into Wellhausen. I'm just saying on a simpler level, do we, as teachers and as families, need to address this, or is this actually messing things up and is raising an issue that kind of will be upsetting and didn't need to be for some students, right? Because you're sort of entering where angels fear to tread. And if the answer is yes, that we should be doing this kind of thing, are we trained to do this kind of thing? In other words, and I guess the part B of it is what should our teachers be trained in? That's what I was going to ask you before, Yitzhak. You were talking about, that the kids need to know geography and ancient Eastern culture. Do we have the teachers who can teach them that? Right? Do they have the training in all of that? So, anyway.
Those are two questions.
I understand that.
I don't think that we should engage in that. I don't think that we should be engaging in that question. How do we know that the Torah is true? It's kind of like saying to my mother, Mom, I want to do a DNA test. I really want to know that you're my mother. Now, I mean, anyone that ever saw my mother would know that it's obviously not necessary because I look just like her. But the point here is that even asking that question is offensive. And why does the question arise? The question would only arise if I felt some distance from my mother. And so the way to obviate the need for the question is to build the relationship. And if I felt closer to my mother, then I wouldn't ever need to ask the question. I would be offended by the question. I would run away from it. Let's do a DNA test and know for sure. So that when kids have questions about the authenticity of the Torah, what they're really saying is that they haven't connected. And therefore, I think the long-term answer is to be personal examples ourselves and to create an argument that's compelling, not because here the Kuzari said this and I can prove it from that and this set of gematrias or whatever proofs you have. The best proof, I think, is when we're able to put forth a unified example of living Torah mitzvah. That is the strongest proof. And when a child sees someone who is living Torah mitzvah and is inspired by that, then the question doesn't arise. Because there's no way to answer the question on those terms itself, I don't think.
I mean, I think you're saying two different things.
I think that
I agree with the solution. I don't think the analogy is sound, because I think to tell somebody that, questioning whether your mother is your mother is the same thing as questioning whether the Torah is divine is really two very, very different contexts. I'm afraid I'd be the one offending you, because I certainly don't buy that. I think that it's a much different proposition to say that, you know, it requires a greater amount of skeptical doubt, almost Cartesian doubt, to say my mother's not my mother. I don't think it requires a great amount of doubt to wonder, like, did this Torah really come from God? You know, so but I agree with your solution wholeheartedly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just, I don't, you know, I fundamentally agree with Josh about what he said. I think that to discuss this during Tanakh class is a waste of time because you're not going to get anywhere. That's not the place.
What would you do? The student asked the question in the middle of class. How would you handle it?
I would say I would love to talk to you about it. And, you know, hopefully in your class, in your school, you also have a Jewish philosophy component. I think it belongs much more there. Of course, you should talk to them. No one should ever say, you know, this is a stupid question or anything. It's a very legitimate question in the sense if somebody does feel alienated, so you have to address it. I wish that all of our kids felt, you know, emor la chochma chotia, not necessarily your mother, but you should have that sense of relationship that this is, that I don't doubt it. But, you know, we live in a world where people do ask the question. Often kids will ask a different question, which is much more common. And how do we know that Judaism is true?
Right.
That's the more common question, rather than Christianity or Islam or something else. And that's an important, and there should be a Jewish philosophy component. But Tanakh assumes it's the divine word. And that's the way you have to start. Meaning, and even Moshe Greenberg has this essay where he talks about teaching Tanakh in a secular Israeli high school where he says, you know, it's really irrelevant what you personally believe. When you come to the class, you have to read a text with the assumptions of the text, if you want to be honest to the text. And the assumptions of this text are that God created the world, that God gave this book, that God really exists, that miracles can really happen, that history really... Now, it doesn't mean that every single thing in the Bible is necessarily historical in the sense of it actually happened exactly this way. Paro might have said it in a little bit way, and Tanakh is quoting him this. I'm not getting into that question. So the sine qua non is the Bible takes itself very seriously. It takes itself as the Word of God, and that's the way it presents itself. And that's when you learn Tanakh. I think that there's a lot of room to talk about those important things in other classes. But ultimately, as Josh said correctly, all the philosophical stuff, the Kuzari, you know, there were 600,000 people. Is that a convincing proof? You know, you can play around with that. Ultimately, it's going to come to the question of context. Did you grow up in a family that lived Torah, wasn't hypocritical, that Torah was exciting and Torah was life and fun and simcha? And that's much more important than that. It's a result of that. There are some individual kids who will be convinced by philosophical proofs. And you have to, and you know, let them read Lawrence Kellerman about, you know, permission to receive and all that jazz. For those who it works for, gewaltig. But it's much more about the nature of their upbringing, the nature of the community. Is Torah something that's living? It's vibrant. It makes sense. It coheres, to use the fancy language today. Is this a coherent system? All that stuff is going to be much more important than any specific philosophical proof you're going to bring.
I beg to disagree.
Okay, good.
You put me on the extreme right. I've milked that as much as I'm going to. I engaged my 12th graders last year at my initiative in a discussion about the issues of biblical criticism. They took to it. They took to it seriously. The response to it was, instead of picking up the hammer and hitting, was to analyze the nail a little more carefully. And many of them said, you know what, I never really thought about that problem, but you know what, in the back of my head, I was wondering, like, two creation stories, et cetera. But I did it with a particular agenda. I did it because I got really scared by Gil Pearl. For those of you who don't know, Gil Pearl, and who was the other guy?
Somebody else.
Did that we know for sure. Did a report on what happens to yeshiva high school students, even the ones who spend a year, and even in some cases 2 years in Israel after high school, when they come back and are at the Ivy League campuses. And the report was something that was not happy. The extent to which dropping out of the religious scene happened within several months of arriving on the campus was happening in numbers far too great to ignore. And part of the issue is that we are not, at least I could speak for the schools that I'm familiar with, are not preparing our students to go into the larger academic world as religious believing Jews with any sort of armament, with any sort of sense of anchoring in what we believe, so that they can contend with what they're going to hear on campus and either feel secure enough to not have to respond or to be able to respond intelligently. And by the way, what happens is that when they come, and in many schools that don't have the blessing of having sophisticated teachers in many of the classes, the students come out with their Judaism being somewhat of a fairy tale, and it goes back to the issue of the avot, et cetera. They come into a university classroom, and of course it's taken for granted either that certain people didn't exist, or if they existed, they were far more faulty, et cetera. And the student at some point very soon says, well, they lied to me about that. They lied to me about the whole thing. Which is, about, by the way, far more convenient when there's a kegger and party going on Friday night to believe that they lied about the Friday night thing, too, because I'd rather be at the kegger than at the Hillel. And that's where a lot of them end up. I think we have an absolute obligation to engage our students, except for those students that we know happen to be, come from very strong families, and their emunah is really tmima. Perhaps there the question shouldn't be raised. With the majority of our students, at least I can speak for our school and the schools that I know, we have to engage them and make them aware of what the rest of the world says about this text and why we don't say that.
Wow.
Not using gematriot. And by the way, we just discovered that if you start from the Bet and Breishit and count every 73 letters, okay, and you count through, it says Julius Wellhausen wasn't here. Not using little tricks and little games and little Purim fest, etc., but rather using serious understanding of Torah and showing that these are issues and showing that there are problems. And one of the principal things I teach my students is, just because somebody asks a good question doesn't mean you have to buy his answer. You can get a very good question from an atheist, from a Christian, from a Muslim, from a heretic, doesn't matter who. If he asks a good question, it's a good question. Doesn't mean you have to read to the end of the paragraph and accept his answer. And by the way, the opposite is true. Just because you don't like his answer doesn't mean you have to reject the question. And Chazal never took that there. So I think that we do have to initiate and integrate a deeper and more solid understanding. Of course, as is appropriate, with the appropriate students at an appropriate age, with an appropriate teacher. Sometimes people need to be brought in to be able to run such a course. Yeah.
The other approaches don't come to college.
I just
go to YU.
I think that Yitzi took it a different direction. I don't disagree with what you're saying at all. I just thought that Elliot was asking as if
we
could.
Panel, I thought it'd be good.
But I personally, when I taught at my EndNote, I actually instituted that also as part of Yidiot Kaliot of 12th grade, one of the units has to be that kids are exposed to the basics of biblical criticism, first of all, to know what it is. They're going to go to college. They should know what it is. What is P, D, E, and G? What's the theory? What's the Regnan theory? What is source criticism? They should see some examples of it. They should see some orthodox responses to it. I also think that, especially in 11th and 12th grade, from time to time, I speak about, you know, this is an interesting issue. Look at two different perspectives. Look at how people who don't believe in the divinity of the Torah approach it. How do we approach it, etc. But that wasn't, I thought, the question,
no,
Elliot.
You're right.
The question really was, can you prove? I think that that's a shemaria, the idea that we can, I think that if we can, I also think that it's a shemaria to think that we can slug up every single kasha, because we can't slug up every single kasha. And we have, yes, we know that some of the early Bible critics, you know, were very tendentious, and you can read the two Genesis stories very differently than Wellhausen, of course, and that's obvious. But the idea that every single thing we have an answer to is not a productive way to go. The more productive way to go is, you know, it's not the methodology that we should be fighting. It's certain assumptions that we come to the text with. And those assumptions ultimately are a product of the kind of education in totality that we give our kids, the kind of upbringing, then a specific. So that's all my point is. I don't disagree with you at all. I mean, I did that, and I do that when I teach, you know, that's...
On the other point, all these questions are a tactical one.
Right.
Where you have 4 hours of Mudei Kodesh.
Right.
You want to get the kids in the best yeshiva,
exactly,
in Israel. Like, they have to learn the Kelanik and the Gemara. And this is all wonderful, but there's not time for it.
Correct.
And the question, you have to prioritize what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, one of my
Menachem, you're talking about their Olam Hazah. I'm talking about their Olam Haba.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to make.
You're worried about their year in Israel. I'm worried about their life. Okay. So it's not so simple to say, you know, because teachers do that. They go, well, you know what? I got my curriculum. I got my lesson plan today, and I can't deal with your existential question. If you do that enough,
right. If you leave no room for them to talk about what they need to talk about.
But there's other kids that if you never there's other kids if you never bring it up, they won't have a problem.
Right.
And then if you don't have the competent teachers, bringing up, I don't think it's a tactical question. You might save two kids, you're going to lose 50.
Agree. That's why we're talking about classroom.
I think tactically speaking.
I also think that all of us would agree, and Yitzi hinted at it, that I also read the Gil Pearl, and you know, and whatever is exact. The bottom line is that 99% of the kids who become not from in college has very little to do with welfare.
That
has
that.
Has very little.
Has to do with Teresa, who's sitting next to him.
Exactly.
Doesn't have to do with well housing.
Teresa well housing. Yeah.
No, I have heard this
she ain't Mother Teresa.
First of all, I think you have to teach in university. Okay, I teach in university. I get letters from my students. Okay, right. And you must be kidding if you think they're not from because of Kant and Wellhausen and all these people. It is a complete myth. Okay, they're not from because they were all the things you said before.
Off the derrick, right? Whatever her name.
So it's a lot of complex factors.
Sure, I don't disagree. No, I don't disagree that this is often used as an excuse. However, there is something else. When students are taught in their Limude Kodesh environment, in a almost like a childish kind of way. And then they come to university, what in their mind happens is it's black and white. That was all stupid, and this is serious.
Right.
And then it becomes much easier when I have Teresa sitting to my, right? And I got the conflict between Moshe Chaim Mechavrusa and Teresa, my new Chavrusa, who I'm going to spend Seder with, that can be the thing that breaks because it's an identity issue. Who am I?
I just wanted to suggest a book to read.
I want you to give these gentlemen a big hand.
Good. Very good.
We have really not so much time for questions, but I'm sure that we can address just a couple. If you want to come up to the mic, mic up in front of here, and then you'll be free to ask them. You'll be free to ask them afterwards. Okay. So just tell us who the question is for, okay?
Probably you. The discussion was fascinating, illuminating. What's that?
Mic. Okay, so you know what? Take this mic.
I know. Where do you press on?
Just speak loudly. We're fine.
It's for the tape. I found the discussion fascinating, illuminating, etc. But I found it very unsatisfying because I think the panelists were talking at cross purposes. And one of the reasons for that, Elliot, and we can take the two gentlemen on the right who are at most at cross purposes, is because, one, you're bringing your own baggage to the table. And by that I mean you're teaching primarily at Queens and Chat. And that's where these type of questions will arise. I'm not sure, I mean, I wish I had Rabbi Avshalom as my high school teacher. I went to Neri Yisrael. None of these questions were ever raised, nor did I ever have a problem while I was in Neri Yisrael. But for the last 35 years, I have had problems, and I've been struggling with them. Okay, but if I go to 80% of my classmates, they don't have any problems. They think I'm crazy. And for them, it would be terrible if this was discussed at high school. So I think that's why I'm so dissatisfied with the questions, because I think what you're talking about is the exception, not the rule. And really, how should we be teaching more to the rule? And then there's a great variation amongst schools, both in the modern Orthodox camp and, of course, when you drift further to the right.
So is this a question for me?
Yeah, well, I mean...
I'll answer your question.
Yeah. I'll answer your question. The question is that he feels that some of the questions and my comments were more directed towards sort of secular-type students, and in the yeshiva, he's saying that most of his peers never had a problem with any of the, you know, sort of issues that rose here. So I'm gonna say two things to that. Okay, number one, I don't think you educate people just on what's not troubling to them. I think if people aren't troubled, they should be. In other words, you are attempting, and I think Menachem is correct, I think it's the level of acceleration of how much you inaugurate them into the complexity of Torah, but the fact that they're not troubled doesn't mean that we end up with a healthy Orthodox community. Okay, so in a way, it would have been better if they'd been a little more troubled,
but troubled in a way where they, their faith wasn't thrown off, but rather they learned certain kinds of Jewish values and certain kinds of tolerance of the fact that it is a complex Jewish world that would have made it, in a way, a stronger, healthier populace across the board. So in other words, just because they don't know biblical geography or, you know, ancient Eastern politics and social structures doesn't mean that their actual hana from learning Tanakh would not increase greatly if they didn't, if they did know these things. So just because they're, the fact that people in society are not bothered by things is no raya for nothing. Most Westerners don't seem to be bothered by the fact that we live in a sort of empty, vacuous, toxic society that's entirely materialistic. That's not a raya that they're correct. Okay? So I'm not making an analogy here, but I'm pointing out that we have an obligation to move people towards truth. That's why we are Orthodox Jews. And if we have tools that can move them towards truth, then I say, let's move them. That's A. B is, I don't actually think that they're not as, they're as untroubled as is made out here. I don't know that there's necessarily a completely frank discourse. And if they're not troubled, their kids will be. And if their kids aren't troubled, their kids will be. But you pay a price in history for the suppression of the truth. Eventually, it comes home to roost.
Okay. Rabbi Berman, I'm not out to get you. I had two questions about the indigestible parts of Torah. First of all, it's very nice to say that Chazal solved all the problems, but what do we do about all of the poor, unfortunate slaves and rape victims and baby Amalekites and so on who had the misfortune to be born between Matzah and Torah and the time that Chazal solved all the problems? And the second question I have is really to Dr. Malamet about raising the question of the indigestible parshas in the first place, which is, how do you know that we have the high moral ground? Assuming that most of us aren't wearing clothes that are union-made, but are wearing clothes that were made in the third world by de facto slaves, where do we have the right to talk about slavery? Where do we have the right in a world where all kinds of collateral damage and civilian deaths are caused by wars that we support or participate in, to start talking about the immorality of attacking Amalek, and so on and so forth?
Well, here's what's going to happen. You're going to answer a question, and this session is going to end, because we have to make schedule.
Also,
all the questions you have can be asked privately.
Maddie and I have to leave, because we have to...
Menachem also has to leave. So, I'm going to say goodbye to Rabbi Leitzak. And I hear...